We are going to continue with, obviously, our study through the book of Esther. And you can find our text this evening in Esther chapter 7 tonight. Last week, as a way of summary, we did leave off with Haman receiving horrible help from his wife and his quote-unquote friends. And we find that in verse 13 of chapter 6, where we read, "And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him." Of course, that was the parade he had to put on for Mordecai. "Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, 'If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him.'" And then you see the second point. This prophecy was ringing in Haman's ear as he was led out the door. And in verse 14, the final verse from chapter 6, "While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared." All right, by show of hands, because these are my favorite, how many of you are planners? Like, you like your week planned out, your... Who's not a planner? Who's just, you know, if I could have my way, I'd go moment by moment. Yeah, okay, a couple of us. I'm definitely a planner. I like to know what I'm going to do. If you went into my office, you'd see a couple little whiteboards where I like to write out goals that I have for each day, things to cross off. There's one time 3 summers ago when I was counseling at the Wild in junior boot camp, so the junior campers, that I had one goal in my entire life, and it was on Thursday, there's one free hour. Now, if Emma would be here tonight, she'd might know this from her training, but with teen camp, you get one free hour every day. They're in a service, you get to take a nap, you get to drink water, you get to take medicine because you're sick. You get to do whatever you want for that 1 hour. For the junior campers, you have to be with them at all points of the day because they're younger. I was going to tell a story about when I lost one on a Friday, but we'll save that for a different day. But Thursday was my goal. Get to Thursday, have that 1 hour, I can go get a nice drink from Cool Beans, I can take a nap, whatever I want to do. So, what do we have to do to get through to that 1 hour? Well, we have to get through an afternoon game. We have an hour to get them cleaned up and ready, because for that hour that I'm gone, they meet me at dinner. So they have to be ready for dinner, the evening service, before I can get rid of them. So, what is that game? Well, Jordan probably knows this rather very well. But the game is that you run through the forest on a little hand-drawn map and try to find 13 checkpoints. There's cards at each checkpoint, and you get better cards the earlier you get there. And I had the most unathletic cabin, which is a very nice way of saying that they were not very fast. So, it was horrible, and they were really bratty, and I was just ready to be done with them for that hour. That's all I wanted. It had just rained. It was muddy. There were puddles everywhere, and so they blew the horn. We had 30 minutes, so they blow the horn. The second horn that's blown, we'll have 5 minutes to get back with whatever cards we have. So they blow the horn. I'm telling you, cabins are flying into the forest just willy-nilly. I'm like, I have no idea where I'm going. The kids don't know where we're going. So they're screaming, they're crying as thorns are ripping out the flesh on their legs. One kid tried to climb over a tree and got stuck. And I couldn't get him down for a while. So finally, we found one card. In all 35 minutes, the second horn goes off. We come back. And that was even an event because a kid couldn't get up the hill because it was so muddy. He kept slipping and rolling back down. And the kids are covered head to toe in mud. So they drove like a safety truck down here, picked the kid up, and brought him back to my cabin. So all that's done. We have literally like 15 minutes now to get them ready for that evening service. And all I'm doing is trying to get to that 1 hour. That's all I'm trying to do. So I'm not proud of what I did. I'm just going to preface that because there was a very long line for the shower. So I said, "Kids, we're going to go wash our hands and our faces, and we're going to put on our church clothes, and we're going to go back to the general headquarters area." So they did. They were covered in mud, and then we put their clothes on and took them back, and I got my free hour. And I'm a horrible person because of that. I understand that. What's my purpose in saying all that? I didn't really have a plan for that day, especially not the running around in the forest at all. I had no idea what I was doing with that. We were thankful to get out alive. Queen Esther had to come up with a plan for something way more important than one free hour of her day, the survival of her people, all the Jews in Persia. She, herself, had to come up with a plan for what she was going to do to save them. And the chapter we're going to look at tonight is her plan. Kind of a lot of pressure. So let's jump into it. Chapter 7, verse 1. second banquet, verse 1. So the king and Haman went into the feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Now, up to this point of the story, we've had two kind of conflicts that have been kind of leading us through. The first one is a threat that the Jews are going to be extinct. They are going to be killed by Haman's royal edict with the king. What's the second conflict? Any ideas? What's that second tension that's been going the whole story?
Mordecai and Haman.
Exactly. The personal struggle between Mordecai and Haman, both up to this point of our story, are unresolved. They are absolutely still out there. In fact, that is what several of the commentaries point at this point, that we're coming to a head at some point. Now, you'll remember last week, chapter 6, Queen Esther didn't show up in our story. This was, of course, the parade for Mordecai when the king couldn't sleep. And he guesses what Queen Esther was doing during that chapter, during that day?
She was planning.
Yeah. She was probably sitting down and thinking, okay, I have pushed this off to one more night banquet tomorrow night. All right, I got to do something. Exactly, Trish. No doubt she was planning every moment of this banquet. Now look in verse 2 real quick. We read, on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast. Now the feast happened at night. And so now we've gone all through the night with this party. And now we're into the next morning. And we read, now they're drinking wine. So this has been quite an evening. And I think Queen Esther had a plan with that. I think Queen Esther wants to get them right where she wants to get them. And it's in verse 3 that she now does what she was going to do. She enacts her plan. Verse 3, then Queen Esther answered, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had merely been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss of the king." Now there's a lot to unpack in there. But first, 78 words, I counted them up. That's all Queen Esther said right there. That's not a lot of words for this huge issue of her people being killed. 78 words, that's all she says in her attempt to save her people. You'll see this note that I saw in a study Bible that I like to reference. King Ahasuerus did not literally expect, of course, this is what he asked her, to ask for half of the kingdom. But her delayed answer must have convinced him that she had a well-thought-out, significant request. And so he's probably genuinely kind of excited to hear what's Queen Esther want, and her request must have caught him off guard. Well, she starts, "If I have found favor in your sight." Definitely a good way to begin. "If it please the king," and this is where it probably turns for King Ahasuerus, "let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people, their lives, for my wish." Do you think the king was a little confused at that request? I mean, a little like, wait, hold up. Wait. Yeah, I mean, they're having a great evening, no doubt. This has been a wonderful time. And then this is her request, like, save my life. What? It's like Queen Esther pulled the rug out from under them by asking this extremely odd request. "Let my life and my people's lives be granted me." Now, her request was direct and to the point. Spare her life, spare her people. One commentator wrote, "Esther passionately implores the king, throwing herself on his mercy and favor, and in so doing, invoking the honor of the one who actually set up their relationship in the first place." She fully reveals here for the first time that she is a Jew. She's about to identify herself with her people. And this is the moment that Mordecai challenged her to get to. It's taken this point, but she's finally gotten here. Her phrasing of, "we have been sold," of course, that's what she said here, "deliver my people, for we have been sold." It actually takes the focus off of the king and Haman for a moment. She's working towards something and puts the focus on her people. Now, why is she doing this in such a weird, cryptic way? Because this is kind of cryptic. Like, she doesn't say here, "Haman's a bad guy and kill him." Like, that's not what she leads in with. Well, she's treading a thin line because she needs, and this is her problem here, she needs to accuse Haman explicitly without implicating the king. So one thing you don't want to do is go, hey, Mr. King, you're the bad guy. You messed up. Not what she wants to do. So how does she do this? Well, she does this by unveiling Haman as the enemy of the king. And she's going to do this through different persuasive techniques. The combination of wine, merrymaking, and the abruptness of Esther's claim must have caught both the king and Haman off guard significantly. And we read here, let my life be granted and my people's for my requests. Now, do we think Haman was just as worked up as King Ahasuerus is about to be at Esther's request? I mean, do we think this caught him off guard? Potentially. I mean, we kind of know that Haman wants to kill the Jews, but as far as he's concerned, what? He doesn't know Esther's a Jew, right? So this probably is catching him equally off guard. Wait, who wants to kill the queen? Because, I mean, he likes the queen at this point, right? He's super proud of himself in the last couple chapters. I have been invited to the queen's banquet, me and the king. He no doubt likes the queen. Well, what do we think changes? It's in verse 4. What about verse 4 might tip Haman off to the fact that there's something afoot and he might be implicated in it?
She mentions how the people were to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. Mm-hmm.
That's it. But why would that trigger Haman's mind?
Because he's the one that implied it to King Ahasuerus.
Yeah. We know here that Esther did her homework because she quotes exactly the language from Haman's edict to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate this people. And so I think when Esther confesses this to the king, Haman's thinking, oh my, and then she says that, and then I think his mind starts racing. Esther's approach, and I'm going to make mention of this a little bit later, was to indict Haman without making Ahasuerus feel guilty. And that's going to bring up this other example in the Old Testament, like the prophet Nathan confronting King David about his sin with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah the Hittite, Esther is trying to lead King Ahasuerus up to the point where, like King David, he's ready to search out this man that has done this horrible crime, and he is ready to kill this man if he can. Now, we'll get back to that in a second. In verse 4, we just kind of looked at it. I kind of find it interesting, Esther's rationale for speaking up, but also her willingness to keep silent. She says, if we had merely been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king. What's that mean? The first part we kind of maybe understand. What's that mean in verse 4?
The king loves Esther, and if she dies, it would be a loss to him.
I like that option. Anything else? If Queen Esther, yeah.
If all the Jews were killed, there would be a tremendous tax loss in the whole country. That would have hurt the king.
Financially, I really do think that's what she's getting at here. And she kind of does it in a way that's almost kind of like insensitive to herself and her people. The rest of the verse, and this is what one commentary said, so I'm glad we're thinking about this together, because it said, quote, the rest of the verse, verse 4, is difficult to translate because some of the key words have more than one meaning. So thank you to the commentaries for that. But while being compared to murder, you know, being sold as a slave would appear slightly better. And Esther says that she would have kept silent and not impugned the king's decision-making, his honor, by pushing back on it. But the seriousness of the situation has compelled her. So I agree. I think her reference to our affliction being less than the loss to the king is a pretty extreme example of laying it on thick. And specifically as terms of slavery. And if I could restate what Esther says there in verse 4, it's almost like she's saying, the death of me and my people isn't as bad as the financial loss you would suffer because of our deaths. Which is almost kind of like, it's very insensitive, but it does make kind of good sense. Look at this quote by Landon. Esther notes she would have not burdened the king with the matter if her people had merely been sold to slavery. Her words express her acknowledgement that the king's time was valuable, and her problem was not with suffering, but with genocide. A pretty strong word, but I think they hit it the nail right on the head. Regardless of whatever specifically Esther meant by the king's loss being greater than Esther's, her impassioned plea did the job. Look with me in verse 5. Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, "Well, who is he? And where is he who has dared to do this?" And Esther said, this is the moment, "A foe and enemy, this wicked Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. One commentator wrote, "Until Esther clearly spelled out that Haman was the wicked enemy, King Ahasuerus had no clue. Whether what she was talking about registered with Haman at that exact moment is unknown, but how could it not, since he had so carefully drafted this decree of doom?" So King Ahasuerus kind of gets worked up here, and I think he's asking a question. The first one might be rhetorical, kind of hypothetical, like, well, who is this man? If it weren't for the second one, and where is he? Which means it's anything but rhetorical now. The king wanted to know immediately who had set out to destroy his beloved queen and her people. A little extended quote here. Haman must have felt doomed immediately because he realized he had not condemned to death just a people from another land, for that had never bothered him before. What was troubling now was that the king's favorite wife also was a Jew. Well, this would be certain trouble for Haman. Haman was terrified, we read, and he had every right to be afraid for his life. His plots and lies had now been uncovered by the one who had more power than he, the king. So everything has kind of come crashing down for Haman here. But earlier I mentioned that sort of comparison maybe to the prophet Nathan and King David. As we mentioned earlier, like the prophet Nathan, Esther has led King Ahasuerus to this place where he shouted, just like King David, "Who is the man?" But she didn't look to him and say, "You are the man," though she could have, and he was responsible for this. He's the king after all. She quickly responds, "A foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman." Now that's pretty strong descriptions of a man. I don't think any of us could probably think of someone who you could identify as, "I'm probably this person's foe and enemy, and they think of me as being thoroughly wicked." I would hope not. But Esther attacks Haman. She attacks his role, his character, and she does not restrict his evil only to his hatred for the Jews. The words she uses is casting him as her enemy. He's tried to kill her. The king's enemy. She's his wife. And the enemy of all people by this string of words that accuse him of villainy. Again, she has one shot at this, and this is what I think is interesting. In this culture, who would get the deferral for belief if it was a he said, she said moment? Would it be the man or the woman? Normally it would be the man, especially here, the king's right-hand man. As she's standing up and saying, "He is the evil villain, Haman." What a risk. What a risk. Look at this extended quote up there. Don't get overwhelmed by all the words. "For the first time in the book of Esther, the king had to make a crucial decision without his counselors." We'll come back to this later. "Suddenly, he was forced to choose between his prime minister and his wife. But if he deposed Haman for threatening his wife and her people, would not Haman simply counter by revealing that the king himself had approved the plan? While the king struggles with his decision," and we're going to get to this in a second, "with his decisions in the garden, Haman stays back with Esther to beg for his life. Before it was Esther who had sought to be spared, but now the tables were turned. And is now Haman who is going to be begging for his life." Let's keep moving real quick. Verse 7. "And the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed back to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was." Now we're going to get into this because there's a lot working here, but the ESV Study Bible briefly summarizes, "Ahasuerus withdrew briefly to compose himself." And that's probably an understatement. I mean, what a revelation he's just come under, that's come to his attention. "Being betrayed by those we have trusted can be deeply wounding and confusing, to say the least." Probably wouldn't have to wait long for you to think of a friend, a family member, a coworker who has betrayed your trust, or maybe you've betrayed their trust. Here specifically, King Ahasuerus trusted Haman, and he trusted him so much that he, without thought, gave Haman his signet ring to put his stamp of approval on whatever Haman thought was best. And here, it's all come back, and it is completely the opposite of what he thought. Now, there's one small note about Haman's edict that we haven't gotten to yet in the story. It's pretty evident at this point. Haman wants to kill the Jews. And I don't know King Ahasuerus' character and personality all that well, because, well, I don't know him personally. But to just casually annihilate an entire race, one commentary gives this added dynamic. And take it for what you will. I just thought it was interesting. One side note about this revelation, one commentator, doesn't matter who it was, his name was Oswald or something to that effect, he adds a potential layer of realization to this moment by proposing why Ahasuerus was so confused and then so very enraged at Haman's betrayal. This is what he claims, and I didn't study it out, but I just offer it to you here as an interesting thought. He argues that the Hebrew word for destroy is very similar in sound to the word for enslave. So as they're talking about this, he offered, this commentator, again, I didn't study it out myself, but we're just putting it here, that the auditory word for destroy and enslave sounds similar, implying that maybe Haman solicited the king's permission to kill the Jews, but did so with an ambiguous word, such as when he followed the request with a payment of money. The king would naturally but mistakenly think that Haman was requesting merely to enslave a group of people. I'm not sure if that's legitimate. I don't have any reason to believe that outside of the fact that King Ahasuerus said, sure, just kill him. I don't care what it is. But if that is what we're bringing into this, and Esther reveals that this man is trying to kill her entire people, that could add a layer of why King Ahasuerus is so upset. He wasn't a stupid man. Financially speaking, Esther isn't off base by saying that killing them all wouldn't make much sense for him and his empire. But talk about a revelation to an already inebriated man. As we've said before, this is already the second day of this banquet. Now, Haman's fear is induced, it seems, by the realization that Esther has given Ahasuerus no choice but to choose between herself and him. Haman reads the signs and senses that this is not going well for him. King Ahasuerus storms out to think about what's going on, and Haman stays back. What do you think Haman is saying in this moment to Queen Esther?
Well, it says right here is begging for his life.
Mm-hmm. He could be saying, I didn't know you were Jewish, or
yeah,
trying to downplay.
I don't really know. I could see it maybe going several different ways. Like maybe he tries to explain it away as something like that. Everything just made so much sense to Haman before this was made known to him. And now to say that it's slipping away from him, I think, is an extremely big understatement. There is irony here, and the tables have certainly turned. Haman replaces Esther as the one who needs to request and beg. And he has to beg, I find this interesting, not to the king, the king's gone at this point, but to Queen Esther herself. What a humiliating situation for this man who thought so highly of himself. Well, the king is walking outside in the palace garden, trying to clear his thoughts and wrap his mind around the fact that his most trusted advisor has not only been deceiving him, but using him to accomplish his evil purpose and against his very own beloved queen. Now, I'm sure it probably wasn't a terribly long time that King Ahasuerus is walking around before he returns. And when he returns, what does he see in verse 8?
He sees Haman falling on the couch.
What's that mean?
Did it look good?
It didn't look good.
Maybe he was drunk.
He no doubt was. And there's a lot of speculation about what that does mean in verse 8, that he was falling on the couch where Esther was. But regardless, and we'll get into this a little bit here, we see what King Ahasuerus immediately thought in the following verse. But regardless, if Haman was going to be destroyed, we know that he was not going to go down without a fight. If he could make someone hurt with him, he would certainly do it. Now, the ESV Study Bible here has a note. Haman was probably kneeling, perhaps with his hands or arms on the couch, probably seeking for mercy from Esther. But the king's perception is distorted by his anger. And he's going to take this and jump to conclusions. Any attempt to save Haman's cause, to kill the Jews, seems to be lost. Now let's take it back even more. Now, even to save his life, it seems to be at a loss. Look at this quote. "The final blow to Haman's life comes by way of a false accusation, not dissimilar to the injustice of false accusations that the Jewish people themselves have suffered at Haman's hands." It's this sort of comedic reversal. And then in verse 8, this is what the king says. "And the king said, 'Will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house?' And as the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, 'Moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high.' And the king said, 'We'll hang him on that.' So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai." Simple sentence here. "Then the wrath of the king abated." Now, to say that the king was filled with rage, filled with alcohol, and filled with fury is an understatement. Now he's even more disgusted by what he thinks to be a physical assault on his wife by this, his newly discovered enemy. We read this phrase that as the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. And this is very concise. The king pronounced Haman guilty. And of course, here in America, that is not how it happens. You're not judge, jury, and executioner all in one person. But again, we're not in America. We are in Persia. He was guilty. And now what to do with him? So we've talked about this a little bit, that King Ahasuerus, pretty much in our story, never makes a decision by himself. He's always influenced by counselors around him, by someone telling him advice, giving him this angle that he might not have thought of. For instance, up in our story so far, he was convinced by others to banish Vashti, and he did without a second thought, to gather virgins and find a new queen, which he did happily, and to help issue an edict that called for the annihilation of the Jews everywhere in his empire. Here, this is now Esther's opportunity to present her request as one more attempt to persuade the king to act. And that's what she's going to try to do here in a second. But pause for our story. Let's take a step back here and let's zoom in here. America, 21st century Bethany Bible Church. Why did God give, I need feedback here, why did God give apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers to his church?
To equip them for the work of the ministry.
To equip them for the work of the ministry, absolutely. Any other reasons?
Disciple.
Disciple, yep. To teach them how to do it themselves.
Wise counsel.
Yeah. Absolutely. Being able to take the word, apply it to our lives. A really, really simple answer is that they're given simply to teach the gospel of Jesus Christ. Big picture, that's a huge goal. That's a huge calling. Now, what happens when Christians fully grasp the gospel and all its implications for life? What happens to a Christian when they do grasp the gospel?
God changes their lives.
Amen. He does.
Filled with love and joy.
Yeah.
They grow.
They do.
They
want to
share it.
It overflows.
I know the lesson is evil thoughts and evil actions come out of the heart. And where do we get that? In this book right here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One application here, Paul contends that when Christians grasp the gospel, when they're grounded in the truth of Scripture, they will no longer be little children tossed by the waves and blown around by every wind of doctrine, by human cunning with cleverness and the techniques of deceit. Essentially, they'll be confident in what they're supposed to be doing. Nothing is better for God's people than God's word, and nothing will better protect them from being manipulated by the whims of the world more than their maturing in Christ. However, back in time now, King Ahasuerus was not in this situation. He was characterized by everything against what I just described should be true about the life of a believer. He was characterized in his reign by listening to those around him in large situations and in small situations. And as we bounce back to this banquet, this habit continues yet again. Who speaks in verse 9? Someone speaks up here. I want somebody to try to say the name, because I'm just like spouting these names off like confidently, like that's the actual pronunciation. Whatever. Harbona is what I'm calling him. Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs. Now, when there's controversy, when there's a big fight happening, how many of you want all the attention to be on you in that moment? No, I'd like to sit off to the side, kind of watch what's happening, pick and choose, maybe after it's all over, say what I think. No. Here, obviously, this is a tense situation. Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs, a man who is probably not called there to speak his mind or to give any suggestion. He worked with Queen Esther, though, no doubt, like many of the king's eunuchs did, and hearken back to the fact that Queen Esther has won people over to her side throughout this entire story. And here, in this moment of greatest need, Esther has done everything up to this point. She's set up her case. She's got King Ahasuerus mad. She's really got Haman right where she wants him. And now the king's deciding, what do I do with him? If he doesn't kill Haman, there's always that threat that he could still be there. In her moment of greatest need, Harbona speaks up and he says, "Hey, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high." Now this guy deserves a raise as far as Queen Esther is concerned. Look how succinctly and effective and short his suggestion was. Point A, there's already something prepared that you can kill this guy with. Haman prepared him for Mordecai. Remember, King, the guy you just had Haman honor yesterday. And I almost imagine Harbona bringing the king over to like the window of the palace and saying, literally right there, because they're huge, these gallows. You can look at them, they're right there. And in verse 9, the king needed nothing else. The king said, "Hang him on that." And then in verse 10, so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. Now, this is definitely a much less gruesome picture if we kind of impose our thought process of a noose of hanging onto this. But when they say they hanged Haman on the gallows, we understand that they hung his body up by being impaled on this incredibly high, sharp stake high above the city skyline. The evil that Haman planned for his enemy fell on him. And a bunch of the commentaries and resources pointed out several proverbs that we have in our Old Testament that kind of apply perfectly to this situation, proverbs that we should apply to our lives because a number of them express truths of what happened here. Here's three. Proverbs 11:6, we read, "The righteousness of the upright delivers them, but the treacherous are taken captive by their lust." Proverbs 29:16, "When the wicked increase, transgression increases, but the righteous will look upon their downfall." Proverbs 26:27, "Whoever digs a pit will fall into it, and a stone will come back on him who starts it rolling." Haman, the enemy of God's people, is dead. And we can kind of take like a deep breath here, right? Problem solved almost. Well, think back here. This is the folly of human wisdom. Think back on famous funeral processions, even in America and England, for instance. Think of President Kennedy's funeral following his assassination, a massive funeral. Think of President Reagan's funeral, Princess Diana, even recently President Bush Sr. Those funerals were beyond large and filled with deep sorrow, not only for the lives of the men and women, but for the legacy that they left behind here. But look at Haman. There was no fanfare for Haman at the end of his life. in spite of craving for it, everything he wanted. There was no hero's send-off, no national mourning. When he'd boasted about being the only guest with the king and queen at the feast that night, he certainly hadn't seen his own demise coming in the way that it did. Yet, that is how God saw fit to happen. And let's real quickly, two verses into chapter 8, because it really wraps up what we're looking at tonight, make some application, and we'll have a short time of prayer. In verse 1 of chapter 8, on that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her, meaning her family member. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Wow. This is good news. This is a happy ending, we think. While receiving the recently deceased Haman's house and his money, it sounds very generous. There's even more that's given to Esther and Mordecai. The idea behind Haman's house was Haman's estate, which included his position before the king as his chief advisor. Finally, King Ahasuerus makes a wise decision, other than killing Haman, by seeing a noble and honest man and appointing him to a premier position in the court. I don't think the king has had a huge heart change here, but if nothing else, he knows that Mordecai is not going to try to deceive him, hopefully, like Haman did. He took off his signet ring, an act that recently got him into serious trouble and the Jews, and confidently gave it over to Mordecai. And Queen Esther, taking care of Mordecai, made sure he received everything due him, including Haman's home. And this is a happy ending of our story. One commentator wrote, "If this were a story about only the conflict between Haman, Esther, and Mordecai, the story would have a happy ending. But we remember that first conflict that's still not resolved. The story, however, has almost lulled the reader to forget one very important aspect, which you all know what it is, but we will look at it next week in chapter 8. So, as we conclude tonight, what do we do with this? What does Esther chapter 7 hold for us today? I'm going to offer that to you guys for a second. Anything stand out to you that I didn't mention that jumped out to you while we're going through that chapter that you think, hey, I think the crowd would like to know this, the group, anything?
Well, one other thing I was questioning is what about the edicts? After he hears everything that she's a Jew and trying to save the Jews, what happens with the edict whenever they're supposed to?
You could read ahead and find that in the story if you wanted to. I'm not going to answer right now because we'll get to that next week and then the following week, because that's still out there. That irrevocable edict, that's actually how the story will conclude. So, you know, come back next week and we'll find out more. Great question, though. Anything else?
It's an example of the fact that one day God's going to right all the wrongs. And sometimes we get all upset at things like Esther could have done, Mordecai could have done. But God's sovereignly in control. He's going to take care of it all in the end, one way or the other.
Yeah. Great. Great application.
It's not as deep, but I think you learn that you can trust God with your reputation when you're trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Because Mordecai went from having this gallows built to 48 hours later watching Haman hang on his own gallows. And just the fact that Haman built this 75-foot spike, you got to think that part of that is the reason people are going to look and see Mordecai, and Haman's going to say, that's what happens if people cross me. And instead, 48 hours later, they're all looking up 75 feet and saying, that's what happens to the man that crosses God's people. Mm-hmm. And it was just an interesting way God had prepared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a great reversal. It's an incredible story. Well, skipping the application for the people who originally read this, I'm going to jump right to us. How can we take this home today? Well, I have 2 points, and these aren't original with me, but I thought they'd be really, really helpful, and we'll expand on them a little bit. First one would be risk much for the gospel. And some comments on that. Esther's life was characterized by great risk. We've seen it this entire story. She went before the king uncalled and identified herself as a Jew to Haman's very face. She knew what it meant to risk her life. And as we consider our lives right now, in this moment, What risks are we taking for the sake of the gospel? What actions are we taking because Jesus is our greatest treasure? Do we have gospel goals that we want to accomplish in our lives? And are we motivated to make those goals happen in the Spirit's power? Listen to Paul's words here to the elders in Ephesus. Paul said, "I consider my life of no value to myself. My purpose is to finish my course and the ministry I received from the Lord Jesus to testify to the gospel of God's grace." Paul lived that unified, focused life, and it's no wonder God worked so mightily through him. Let us risk much for the gospel. And secondly, live so that when what is concealed is revealed, it will be for your reward and not your ruin. Haman made many plans and purposes in the counsel of his own mind. We didn't necessarily see those plans coming together, but today many men and women sin against God and against others with no thought of a God who is watching, but unfortunately also with no thought to a God who is ready to offer grace. Haman made a calculated move to potentially assault Esther when the king left the room. Let us always remember that our king is in the room and expects obedience, but empowers that obedience by his grace. The days God grants us can never be repeated, and let us not waste any of them, but live each day for God's glory. Those are my two applications from this specific chapter. And let's jump right into, because of our chapter today, why is Jesus better than everything today in chapter 7? Think of Haman. Think of King Ahasuerus. Why is Jesus better than what we saw through their lives during this chapter? Any thoughts?
I don't know how to put it, except for retribution. He's just.
Yeah, he's just, which is infinitely better than Haman.
He knows the end, not just the beginning.
That would be like Haman, kind of thinking he knew what was going on in the situation, that God knows everything. Yeah. I have two. Unlike the king, specifically, and we talked about this earlier, but it keeps coming up again, Jesus needs no counselors, and he always does what's right. And then secondly, this is about the king's wrath, King Ahasuerus' anger. Jesus took all of God's wrath for us on the cross. The Father will never reach out again in eternal wrath and strike his children. Just several ways of why Jesus is better, even because of this chapter. So let's wrap it up here. One final little paragraph. The terror that Haman experienced is similar to the terror that will be known by all who have uselessly plotted against God. This reality makes us grateful for the gospel, through which even Haman-like wickedness can be fully and freely forgiven. For in God's plan, Christ hung not on gallows, as Haman did, but on a cross, where the penalty of the sin of all who trusted in him was fully paid. So that's Esther chapter 7, and we'll jump into our story next week. So let's close in prayer. Father, we do thank you for this shorter chapter, but an action-packed chapter of you're preserving your people and you're working through seamlessly hopeless situations. We do pray that as we move now into a time of prayer, that you will bless our church and you will bless us with physical health, with spiritual health. We're excited to see what you will do through these seemingly difficult times. And we'll trust you for the outcome. In your name I pray. Amen.